Hey, this is Jim McDonald. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone to leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes. We really appreciate it. Whether you use iTunes or not, it just takes a couple minutes, and it means a lot to us. Also, please support our sponsors, BSN, HowMuchYouBench.net, ThePowerMagazine.com, and CavemanCoffeeCo.com. This episode is also brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at thepowercast.com/audible. That's thepowercast.com/audible. There's over 1,500 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. One of my favorite audiobooks of all time is Crush It by Gary Vaynerchuk. And if you're looking for a way to be your own boss, that's a book that will light a fire under your ass. Now, let's get the music started.
It's okay, we don't fucking bring him. Fuck that guy.
Dick Lickerson.
Best name in the podcast.
Oh, fuck.
We'll have you guess his body weight once you hear this.
That's deceiving.
Yeah, yeah.
Live at Super Training Gym in Sacramento, California.
That's him?
Yeah.
Mark Bell's Powercast.
Yeah, guess his body weight.
PowerMagazine.com.
180.
Yeah, we wish. We wish. What is he, 350, 340?
Holy. Bodybuilding.com. Alongside Silent Mike and Jim McKee, here's your host, Mark Bell.
There we go.
Yeah.
We weren't recording Smelly there for a second.
Yeah, he weighs about 350, I think.
Damn.
Or he used to. I think he's lost some weight, actually.
350.
That's deceiving because you hear those guys on the radio and they're like,
hey.
They look like they're like 350 and they're like 160.
Right, yeah. Their voice is real deep and baritone and stuff.
Yeah.
We're here today with Matt Winning. Matt Winning has successfully squatted 1,197 pounds back in his multi-ply cheating days. And now he does some raw lifting. And I believe your best squat's 840 so far in competition.
Yeah, 845.
845, and Matt's someone who's been around for a long time. He competed in just about every federation you can think of, and it's an honor and privilege to have him here.
Thank you.
Because we're going to fire some questions his way, and hopefully we'll be more smarterist by the end of this whole thing. What have you been up to lately, Matt? What's been going on with you lately?
Just working with the military. Just got done working at 82nd Airborne at Fort Bragg, and just been doing a lot of writing and just working at the gym with various people.
With the military guys, is there a huge emphasis on pec deck?
I always tell people there's three different types of people in the military. There's guys that like to lift weights and, you know, do bodybuilding bullshit. There's guys that want to run all the time, and there's guys that don't want to do anything. There's the three guys.
Right.
You know, very rarely do you find the guys that are pretty good at all of it, but those are the ones that are really the best soldiers.
Right.
Ones that are good at all the different variabilities. I can put them in anything, and they look really good. It's kind of like us with lifting. You know, if
right.
you put us in any particular movement, we're going to be pretty good at it because we right. train all kinds of different ways.
Yeah, and most of us have some sort of athletic background of some sort yeah. as well.
Definitely. What's your athletic background before lifting?
Well, I played football. I got a scholarship offer at Ball State to play football and decided.
Isn't that a very African-American school, or am I way wrong?
No, it's
maybe
it's,
I'm off.
It's fairly.
What is it, Ohio?
No, it's in Indiana. It's actually in my hometown.
Oh, okay.
It's the only D1 school that's in that area that's close.
You're the smartest person from Indiana, in the history of Indiana.
I don't know.
What about Larry?
You talk a lot faster than they do.
Yeah, that's true.
David Letterman.
Very true.
There you go.
Yeah, I don't know if he's originally from Indiana, though. I think he went to Ball State, so did the guy from Papa John's. Those are the two
Papa
guys
John's,
that are
John's
famous.
Pizza. That guy sounds pretty smart.
Those are the yeah. guys that are pretty famous. And actually, if you watch those commercials with that Camaro that he has, that you know, that dark brown split bumper, he sold that car to start his first Papa John's and then
it's
found
amazing.
It and he did it.
Oh, there you go.
I just
bought
that.
It back.
Yeah, yeah. So
he's your neighbor.
Yeah, I don't think he lives there anymore. Place is a shithole.
He got the fuck out.
But yeah, so I started with football, and I was a really good swimmer when I was a kid because a lot of people don't know this, but I broke my legs when I was going into first grade. I got hit by a car going about 50 miles an hour on my
Damn.
Bicycle.
Shit.
And I was in full-legged cast for an entire year in a wheelchair.
Where was this? Like,
this was actually
this
was
near
actually,
a freeway or something. Or
this
what?
Was actually I lived right across the street from the pool, and we were riding. It was probably 2 weeks before first grade started, and we were out riding bicycles. And it was it's a pretty laid-back neighborhood. It was a nice neighborhood when I was a kid. You know, obviously that was 25, 30 years ago, so it's not as good now. But
right.
We were just out riding bicycles, and it was my fault that I went out in the middle of the road. But the lady was doing 50 and a 25. And I got T-boned. Don't even remember. I just remember waking up in the ambulance and in those compression pants they put me on, and then I woke up in the ER and surgery, and that's all I remember.
You were 7 years old, 8 years old.
I was going from 6 to 7, I believe.
Was there anything else going on, or just kind of broken legs?
I fractured my pelvis, broke my femurs each twice in two different places, and then fractured my right leg below my knee in 6 places, and they almost cut it off.
Oh, shit. Anything happen to your face, or your face has always been
My face has always been fucked up. So, that's just genetic fucking.
Fuck, man. Too bad that car missed your face.
Yeah, you
God
know.
Damn.
I don't know if I'm missing or I gained a chromosome.
But it definitely knocks some screws loose. That's
but yeah,
sure.
A lot of people don't know that. And
that's crazy.
It's really hard for me, too.
I've never heard you talk about it before.
No, when I come into the gym and I hear people crying to me about their fucking knees and their bullshit problems with their back, I'm like, dude, fuck you.
I got run over by a fucking car.
I got fucking hammered by a car and squat 900, okay? So
what your parents must have been. I mean, they must
well, that
have been...
was the most crazy thing is my mom was actually the director of surgery at that time.
Ah.
So she was awaiting my arrival and knew that I got smoked by a fucking car.
Whoa.
So she was in the
did
ER.
Did that help her at all?
Yeah,
having the medical background?
A little calmer than a normal mom?
I think, I mean, she kind of just told me she just went into work mode, you know, at that point, but...
She must have had to be strong for you, because if you saw her breaking down, that probably would have made 10 times worse for you.
I was so fucked up on pain meds when I came in there as a kid. I didn't even know.
Okay.
I didn't know where I was. I didn't know I was at my mom's work. I mean, you know, at 5 years old, your mom works at a hospital. You don't know where you're at.
Yeah.
So
people are yelling. You're getting moved around.
I never heard about what my mom went through until I was, I'd say, 20, 21 years old.
Yeah.
And she could, you know, you're finally old enough to realize, like, what the fuck you just put your parents through. Like, you know, and it's not like I learned from my mistakes.
Right.
It's like I got smoked by a fucking car. And then,
and now you're riding around a motorcycle with no helmet.
Exactly. Across the country.
With grandma.
And then taking my grandma. So I'm trying to kill my entire family now. So, so when that happened, swimming really took off for me because it didn't hurt. Like, I could be really
flat. Is it a long recovery process?
I can tell you this, is like I said, you know, it's hard to remember between ages of 5 and 10, but I remember being it a complete motherfucker to walk right ever.
Wow.
Like, from the time I was about 7 and a half when I got out of my cast till I was about 11 or 12, I tried to play baseball. I tried to play basketball. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously weights at that time.
Right.
This was in the early 90s, late 80s. You know, nobody used weights for playing sports at that age.
Yeah, not as much. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, even now they still
don't.
So it wasn't a huge, it wasn't a huge deal. So I didn't know about weights until I was about 12 years old, and I remember from swimming, my upper body was – I swam the 50 free and used all arms and lats.
Right.
I think that's where my shoulders and my lats started to grow.
Yeah.
And I couldn't use my kicks a whole lot because, you know, my legs were still underdeveloped. And
you're inspiring a lot of people to start swimming now.
Yeah. I think swimming's great for kids. I just wish that I would have been pushed into, like, you know, you read a lot of the Soviet books on gymnastics and mobility.
Yeah.
I think at that age when I got out, you know, physical therapy was still pretty new in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And they still didn't really know what they were doing. I still sometimes think now they don't know what the fuck they're
right.
doing.
Right.
But
sometimes it's a little guesswork.
Best guess all the time.
Best guess always. So the big thing of it was if I had it to do over again, I would have done things that would require me to be more mobile and not as cyclic, i.e. swimming. And I was only ever good at a 50, which – I always thought is because I was a bigger kid and I was just fucking lazy.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized as I got into weights, I was explosive as shit. And I was like, I didn't have the slow twitch fiber to do 200s.
Right.
So I would be dying out on 200s when we would be practicing, but I would still get faster. So by the time I got done with swimming, I was about 14 and I was swimming like a 24 second 50, but I weighed 200 fucking pounds.
Oh, shit.
So I was the biggest kid on the swim team and I was close to one of the fastest kids in a 50.
Right.
And what was funny was that I, you know, after that I got into weightlifting, and my last year as a grad student, I was the strength coach for swimming because we had to rotate teams depending on when our classroom schedules were.
Uh-huh.
And they talked me into coming in and swimming against the swim team on the 50 free.
Oh, cool.
And I'm like, all right. So the week before I practiced my flip turns and my starts a little bit. And I swam a second faster at 285 pounds than I did when I was 200 when I was a kid.
And what's your height for our listeners?
6'1".
Yeah.
So I'm 6'1", 280, and swam, I think it was a 24.60, which still, you know, I mean, a good guy swims like 18 to 19. I think that's pretty fast. But you think about it. I mean,
body weight. Yeah, what's Michael Phelps weigh? 220, 6'7", or something?
Yeah. So, I mean, you figure you're swimming within 3 to 4 seconds of what the top guys in college are swimming, you're 280, and I'm built like a fucking powerlifter.
That's crazy.
But I remember jumping
some
off.
Some of the sprinters are fair, they have some size to them, though,
yeah,
right?
They do, but a big
Not 280, but 220 maybe.
A big swimmer is 210 to 220. That's a big swimmer.
Right.
So it was just, you know, like I said, it wasn't a world-class time by any means, but if there are weight classes, I challenge anybody to do that. Yeah. You know.
You might have had some buoyancy going on there.
Well, kind of. Not really. I remember jumping off the starting blocks, and I was so fucking jacked to swim against these guys. And it was just like a little college meet.
Right.
But I jumped off, and when I jumped off, my body weight, I hit the bottom and ripped the fucking hairs right off the front of my body. And I can just remember screaming on the water.
You're probably the only swimmer with a fucking hairy chest.
Yeah. I look like when Bruce Lee ripped fucking Chuck Norris's hair out of that one karate movie.
Oh, my God.
That's what it looked like at the bottom. I got out and there was fucking hair missing off my stomach and shit. And I couldn't breathe for like a half an hour.
Were you more dynamic without the hair, maybe?
No, I didn't notice that. I just noticed it got me really pissed off. So. Like, ow, that fucking hurt.
I got to swim faster.
That was brutal, but it was funny because it looked like a fucking, you know, somebody threw a bowling ball from a 747 about 10,000 feet when I hit the water. But I was still fast. So, but that's how I got into swimming, is it just didn't hurt, and it was something I could do physically active.
Did you get teased and stuff in those years when you were walking weird and stuff?
I don't think it necessarily showed as much as it felt.
Okay. But it just felt, you felt unstable.
Yeah, I just remember like it being hard to do certain things on the playground or play baseball and stuff like that. And it really – I think that's how I started to get into weightlifting, because I was kind of internal kind of guy. That's why I liked weights and swimming, because I couldn't hear anything, and it was just me against, you know, me. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I became.
So it wasn't like a team thing, you know?
No, yeah.
You're selfish.
I was always into selfish shit. So. Yeah.
Well, it sucks, you know, when you're on a football team or a basketball team, the other guys don't perform well, and you got, you know, a couple guys on the, like, usually like a high school team. If it's not a real serious high school, there'll be like three or four actual basketball players on a basketball team. The rest of them are just there.
Yeah.
And same with football, you know, and so that can be frustrating. It's kind of cool to be in a sport where you're just against the clock, or you're just against the weight.
I just remember I played nose guard, and I remember that I was so strong even as a younger kid in high school that every team we would play, we had other guys that played defensive tackle and stuff. But they were kind of fat, sloppy guys, and I would always get double or even sometimes triple teamed. And I was like, this is no fucking fun at
all. Mike gets double teamed a lot.
Not you on know. The football field. Never played football once. Double teamed all the time.
So that's kind of where I kind of started drifting away, even though I was probably genetically inclined. I started looking into it. And I remember my senior year, I was so big into weights by that time for 4 or 5 years. My first bench meet I did. As a freshman, I benched 250, and I only weighed 190, and that was my first bench meet. And then the next bench meet I did, like 6 months later, I already went up to 365. Damn. So I was naturally a really good bencher. So I remember my sophomore year, I benched 365. My junior year, I benched 440. And my senior year, I was right on the 500 mark.
Wow.
But I was already going to national meets in the USAPL.
Right. That's drug tested federation.
Yeah.
Everybody who's listening.
Yeah, that's the other
don't
thing.
Don't be a hater.
Yeah, is I made it really, really far without the advent of any of that shit.
Right.
You know, I always tell people, you know, whether you want to use or not use, that's your particular, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's your own thing. Yeah.
It's your own prerogative, but make it somewhere without anything first and then decide.
All right, all right. I hear you.
I don't. Yeah, I don't.
Like, everyone's just lecturing
the
me.
Same speech. Mike.
I came to podcast. I'm getting lectured.
No, it's not. It's not a lecture as much as I think it's just one of those. I think it's a rite of passage. I mean, you know, it's one of those things. You got to know that regardless of whether you're taking things or you're not, you're still gonna have to put in an ass load of work.
Right? Yeah. Get your programming dialed in. Get your nutrition dialed in. Put some years in.
And
it's a little bit like when the powerlifting gear, bench shirts and stuff were popular. Guys that were benching like 250 were jumping in them right away. And it's like, well, that's okay, but you'd probably be better off getting a little bit better of a base before you jumped in.
And that's where I got really lucky that Ed Cohen was really close to where I grew up. I grew up in Indiana.
Never heard of him.
And Eddie was in Chicago. And, you know, the reason I was lucky was that the guys, even in the normal gyms in that area, because Chicago was so close, people knew of him and knew the things he could do.
Yeah.
And it was like, once you got to a certain level, you're like, you need to go contact this crazy little fucker. So I show up in Chicago thinking I'm getting ready to run into, you know, like a Dick Butkus, and this dude comes out of the thing looking like fucking Jack Frodo.
Yeah, he's 5'5", 5'6".
And I'm like, wait a minute. You're the baddest fucking lifter in the world?
Yeah, where's your neck,
and then and then he shakes my hand, and I'm like, oh, my God.
Right.
You know, I'm just like, this dude is a beast. So,
he's got those mitts.
But he told me the same thing. You know, he's like, you know, I'm a good lifter because I can do all this stuff without. And that's when I realized that, you know, the gear was cool because I could lift more weight, but I could take it off and still whip most people's asses out.
Right.
But,
Yeah, and he had good technique either way, and everybody should be the same. Everyone should be working towards that.
Yeah, I think that's true. But we all know that getting strong raw and having good technique takes years and years, and we live in a society where we want that instant gratification, and that's just not the way it is.
Yeah, you talked about that earlier with speed work. Hmm. You were saying that, like, you know, speed work, you don't notice, like, it might not happen in 3 weeks. It might not happen in 4 weeks. It might take a long time, right, to really have the speed work pay off.
Yeah, people that watch my Instagram or Facebook accounts or anybody that posts my speed bench videos is like, holy shit. Yeah. This dude is fast as hell.
Yeah, I think people are more amazed at your speed work than they are, you know, even though you bench over 600 pounds.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the reason that that's the case is because I've done speed work religiously for 12 or 15 years.
Right.
And, you know, and I've kept it lighter and over a long period of time made the speed work heavier. And
you want to describe your type of dynamic or speed work for our listeners?
Yeah, like basically, well, if you want to just take the bench pressing.
That's all we care about anyway. Yeah, let's stay there.
So
for the people in Indiana, he moves the bar really fast. That's it.
So
real fast.
Real fast. So basically what we do is I work my speed work in a six-week wave. And what we do is we start off, obviously, if you know anything about weight training, you know there's a difference between explosiveness, speed, strength, and strength speed. Those are just variations of percentages, which basically means you're on the explosive side of weights, you're a little too light. In the speed strength side, you're about optimal, and the strength speed side, you're a little too heavy.
Moving a little bit slower.
Right. So you progressively slower as the weights get heavier, obviously, right. Which doesn't take a fucking rocket science to understand. But the key is you have to be explosive in all those areas. So what I figured out was why not train those areas in a 3 week wave? So what I do is I train with about 185 bar weight, so 30%
right
ish area. And then I'll use a double red band, which is about 110 pounds of tension. I'll do that for 8 sets of 3. Then the next week I add one chain on top of all that, and the next week I add 2 chains. Then I take 1 week down and do 15 sets of 15 of real weight to build up muscle mass and give my CNS a break.
15 sets of 15?
Yeah, so this lasts
like, fuck you, German volume training.
Yeah, with like 275 or something.
So,
I mean, for your
strength
level.
This is what I do is I progressive it. So what I do is I'll start the bar at 135, and this last cycle, last Sunday exactly before I left, I did 405 for 15 on my 15th set.
Wow.
Okay, so that's how much volume it takes to get really, really big and strong. But the week after that, it goes to a 185 and a double black band, mini band, right. Monster mini. So now we got about 140 pounds of band tension. And then I'll do that week one, week two, add a chain, week two, add another chain. So I'm at top accommodative resistance and weight. I'm at 185, 2 chains, and a double monster mini band.
Right.
And then the cycle starts all over again, and that doesn't change until my max rises. So this last year I benched 606, and this last year I barely missed 611. That means my speed work weight did not change.
Right.
That's where people get screwed up, is they think if they progressively increase that weight that they're going to get stronger, but in reality you're going to get weaker because you're overtraining your percentages.
Right.
Okay.
So that doesn't change until your max effort strength changes.
Some of the things that get tricky about speed work is like, you know, people are sometimes confused about how fast it should look and how fast is the goal to progressively move the bar faster over a period of time?
Well, you only get so fast. I mean, you know, and that's the thing is, but you want to stay in that range. So the old literature talks about 0.7 or higher meters per second, which is pretty fucking fast. But the progression is to maintain the speed while the strength rises. So you're able to increase force production. So basically what that means is that as I slowly increase the weight on the bar due to my max rising, my force output becomes greater because my acceleration is the same, but the weight is heavier.
Gotcha.
But this could take 8 to 10 years.
Like, right.
And that's what people don't want to hear. Well, I want to get better next week. Well, it doesn't work that way.
Do you mess with tendo units or anything like that to measure your speed?
Well, back in the day, you know, when we all trained at Westside, we were big into those tendo units because we were first learning speed.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were there, early 2000s, and I started showing up, on the weekends, early 2000s, we were using the tendo unit a lot because we didn't understand speed work.
Right.
But then once we figured out it was over 0.7.
You're trying to get a feel for it, basically.
Yeah, and even back then, we were using speed work too heavy. And that's when I realized that usually a good indicator for the listeners, a good indicator for speed work is 72 hours later when you do your max work, you should feel fresh and ready to destroy shit. If you still feel tired from max work, it's automatic indicator that it's too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
It should feel like a restoration process, but it's still a CNS activity.
So you'd be better off like starting off way too light if you're just starting to think about doing some speed work.
Well,
you'd be better off starting way light.
A good point or a good rule of thumb is if you can bench 405, you should use 135 for speed.
Yeah, I was going to ask, give us an example of a speed work cycle with like 315. 315 is a pretty common max effort bench for some
people. If you're a 300-pound bencher, you should use about a quarter and a dime on the bar with a double red.
115 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah, 30 to 35, 40% tops.
Are you doing sets of three?
Yeah.
I can understand that with the band, whether just free weight. I mean, people tend to kind of get all over the place.
Well, that's
really light.
Well, yeah, that's the problem is with free weight. And that's really the reason that bands and chains work is it makes speed work more potent because it's trying to slow the bar down even though it shouldn't.
Right. Yeah. It's more optimal.
It's more optimal. And like I said, if you're worried about stuff breaking and things, you're better off going chains because you can throw them out in the street and run them over, and it's not a big deal.
Right.
So if you invest in a set of chains, those chains will be there longer than you.
Right.
The bands are something that has to be replenished all the time. Right. And, you know, I buy a new set of bands every 6 months for the gym, which gets expensive. But my point being is if you really want to use accommodative resistance, you should use chains if budgeting is an issue. But speed work still does work with free weights. It's just not as optimal because you're going to overspeed the bar at the point of change of direction, which would be off the chest, but you're not going to get enough work at the top because the bar is already accelerated.
Yeah, some deceleration occurs when you use straight weight, correct?
Right, exactly. You're actually going – your body's going to realize that the bar is already moving and automatically slow its you know, motor unit recruitment down. Mm-hmm. Because if it already knows something's moving, it's going to try to conserve energy.
Right.
Do you think the speed work has helped you through sticking points and stuff, you know, through lockout and things like that because you're accelerating the bar so hard and so fast?
Yeah, I think eventually the weights have to move faster in order for them to go. You can only have so much grinding power, and eventually you just have to get more explosive.
Right.
And I think that becomes more more seeable as you get stronger. It becomes one of those things where speed work, you can get by and get pretty strong without it, and then once you're up to the point you need it, it's going to be a long fucking time before you get stronger again, so you might as well just start with it.
What about some different exercises to work explosiveness? You into like any kind of plyo movements, medicine ball tosses, box jumps and stuff?
We do a lot of box jumps up to stuff. So like at my peak level when I'm getting ready for meets, I can jump up to a 28-inch box with 100-pound dumbbells in each hand.
Oh, okay.
And I weigh 300.
Yeah.
So that's real fucking
power.
It's
like a baby elephant.
So when I see these when I see these lightweight guys jumping up with jumping up to a 60-inch box with no weight on them at all, that's not nearly as impressive to me as them jumping up to a 30-inch box.
Calling me out on everything now.
100-pound dumbbells. Right. I mean, cuz that's real transfer of power.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, when you could take
and sometimes the box jump gets to be like a demonstration of flexibility and stuff too. Because
People
are able, people are able to pull their feet up to where their shoulders are practically and land.
Well, that's why, in my opinion, you know, Olympic lifting is one of the biggest. I mean, it's cool as shit. I love watching it, and I'm not an anti-Olympic lifting guy, but it's one of the biggest farces of absolute power ever. Because if you can get under the bar quickly, you can defeat the weight.
Right.
And with powerlifting and deadlifting, there's only one bar speed, and that's fucking suck.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? And that's the thing. You really have to strain. Like I said, I take nothing away from those guys because the top guys in the world are badasses. But a lot of these dudes that fuck around with this stuff and they got under 225 on the bar, I'm like, you're not showing me anything powerful.
Right.
Because you're crawling under the bar.
It's some speed and some technique is more of what it's displaying.
Really. I watched Klokov yesterday in the grid match. My God, he's huge. Yeah. He's not fast, though.
No,
his bar speed is fast, but his cycle time is pretty slow. Yeah. I guess that he said that in Russia they would make fun of you if you moved the bar fast over a bunch of repetitions in a row.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, to me, just from the small stuff that I've seen, he's one of the most impressive guys that I've ever seen as far as all around just badassery.
Yeah.
Because that dude can lift heavy. He can do crazy amounts of weights with highly explosive exercises.
Yeah, 700-pound deadlift, 500-pound bench,
but
700-something-pound squat.
Right, you know, that's why I give him so much credit because he actually goes out and tells people it's time to just get fucking strong.
Right.
And, you know, and there's not a lot of these Olympic lifters and stuff like that. They just don't – I mean, people fail to realize that the last good Olympic lifter we had is a super heavyweight squat at 1,000 fucking pounds.
Yeah.
Shane Hammond.
Yeah.
Okay, you have to be super fucking strong if you want to do crazy shit.
Yeah.
If you want to be able to clean 405, you got to be able to front squat 600. I mean, that's just the way it is. If you front squat 455, it's going to be really hard to clean 405.
Right. Because
you're not going to be able to create enough power. It's like watching that Razadeh guy from Iran.
Oh, yeah.
Before that 04 Olympics, he was doing 800 for doubles on front squats.
That guy's a maniac.
Yeah.
Well, if you can do 800 for fucking front squat, you can power clean 570.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It all comes back down to percentage of max. So 570 for him is only 70% of his total work capacity, so he can move it quickly.
Yeah, I think he's done 600 in training or something like that too.
But if it's 90% of your best,
it's going to be rough.
It's going to be really rough, and that's what people don't understand it, because we don't want to sell people that, because it's going to say, hey, Mark, you want to bring your bench up to 650? It's going to take me 8 years to get you there, and you're like, well, fuck that, right? Me and you both know 8 years goes fast.
Yeah, it does.
People don't want to stick with things that long, though. No. They want that instant result.
Yeah, and that's what I like about what we do, is that you got to buckle down for a long time to get good.
Yeah, Mark talks about that a lot. Is, you know, even though he's put up some crazy numbers and he's friends with you who put up even crazy numbers, he sees a 600-pound deadlift and he's like, I know how many years that took that guy to do that.
Right. Yeah.
And he put in some work.
You're always going to run into guys that can get it faster than you.
Yeah.
But the key is where you start and where you finish.
Right.
And like I try to tell people, the way I think about things and how I train is I like to listen to the guy that's done insanely crazy shit and had minimal injuries, because that dude's had to really be thoughtful and bring the heat when it needed to be brought in, and also back off when he needed to heal.
Yeah.
And that's not the same thing.
It's hard.
People have to be blessed in both ways. They got to be blessed to be fucking crazy, and then they got to blessed to be fairly fucking smart and back off. And those two things usually don't go together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We all know that. So.
Yeah, Stan Efferding did a very good job of that. I mean, he'd kind of just go heavy every other week.
Yep.
Like, as he got older, he just learned that he needed to back off.
And, like, to me, even just from reading his stuff, and I've never really met him, but he's one of the most guys that I have the most respect for. I'm not nearly – I think he's 10 or 12 years older than me.
Yeah.
But
he's not young.
I have a lot of respect for him because of his ability to find out what his body needs and make him get better without beating himself into the ground.
Right.
And that's who I want people to idolize, is people like Stan Efferding that push world records at 45 years old.
You know,
because that is the type of shit that tells me that guy knows what's going on. So.
Right. What do you think about the, we've talked about a little bit about speed work for the bench press, and it transfers over well to raw and geared lifting. What about speed work for the squat and for the deadlift? Does it seem to transfer over to raw lifting?
Yeah, well? I think it does. But like I said, it all comes back down. I mean, my philosophy on training is it all comes back down to what you need. So for me, I was always an explosive deadlifter, and I was always an explosive squatter.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to train speed work with that nearly as much because I already have it. So I've slowed everything back down and tried to just get that grinding strength back and or not back or just increase it. So I think it depends on what you need.
So you do a little bit more max work now rather than speed work for
the
lower
body. I do max
work
and a little bit more heavy sets of threes and fives just because as I've taken the gear off, my muscles have to do all the work.
Right.
So I have to have that time under tension in order for my muscles to develop, because my CNS from being in gear is probably one of the greater CNSs in lifting right now. I'm explosive and I can move stuff really fast, but now my muscles have to catch up because I don't have the support anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's good. I would rather have CNS and work on my muscle than the opposite way around. But
what do you think about a box squat? Does that have application into raw lifting?
Yeah, it does. But like I said, it depends, like we talked about that earlier, but it depends on if you're a good box squatter, then you need to squat free. And if you're a good free squatter, you need to squat with a box. People look at me and go, well, he squats with a box all the time. Look how good his free squat is. I was good at a free squat before I started box squatting.
Right.
So I squatted, I squatted close to 800 IPF rules, walked out.
Yeah.
And I hardly ever trained with a box back then because we didn't have them. We didn't know about it.
Yeah.
That was in the, late 90s and early 2000s. And the big thing of it is the box made me worse. So I use it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people don't understand is like, I use a box squat because the box squat takes away my stretch reflex.
Meaning the box squat's harder for you.
Yes. Yeah.
What made therefore you choose, making you better.
What made you choose a box squat over like a paw squat? Or why should someone?
Well, I think the paw squat is really easy to destroy form.
Right.
I think you have to be fairly skilled in order to keep the tension on the right muscles with a paw squat. I think a good progression would be to get good at free squats, then get good at box squats, and then get good at paw squats. Mm-hmm. If I were to say, hey, how do you progress this? Because the paw squat, if you're not a great squatter, will tear your form to pieces. It'll actually teach you to be hesitant at the bottom to actually separate the movement.
Right.
Whereas I don't notice that it does that with me or anybody I train with a box.
Right.
So paw squats work very, very well only when your form is impeccable, in my opinion.
Do you feel that a box squat is like a completely different movement than a free squat, or those people that are trying to have the box squat help their raw squat, should they look similar?
They should be almost identical. And the biggest thing I see with people that box squat, and the reason it doesn't transfer over to a free is because when they sit on the box, they're not tight. Like right, the box should be a seat that you sit on, but you don't relax pressure, especially laterally. So my feet are still pushing. My body is still super, super tight. The only thing I'm separating is the eccentric and concentric motion. I'm not – the box is not really helping me sit back and, like, you'll see a rocking position. So they'll sit, rock, and then rip it out. That's not going to transfer it over to a free squat. But if you sit down and you stay in the same position and pause on that box and then have to stand up without any you know, any
momentum,
that's going to be a huge carryover. But that's the biggest issue I see with box squatters is they, when they sit on the box, it's a full relaxation. They don't, they're not staying tight.
Tightness is so hard to communicate to people. I've been thinking about it lately, and it's a little bit like the difference between shouting and singing. Because when you shout, you don't really care what it sounds like. But if you're singing, you're trying to hit a particular note.
Yeah.
So you're controlling your vocal muscles in a particular way to get a particular sound.
Well, I don't think it's so much that you're trying to, that it's not replicating, is that our bodies are designed to be efficient. And when you do something really, really hard that makes something harder, the body is going to try every way it can not to do that.
Yeah.
So when you sit on a box, the body goes, oh, I can relax. And you can. But it's not going to transfer over to the free squat. And that's where you get the big separation between guys who can squat with a box and you take it away and they look like shit.
Yeah.
Is because they have, you know, they've used it as an advantage versus a disadvantage. So if I'm a good free squatter, but my box squat sucks, I should probably train that box squat. If I'm a good box squatter and I suck at free squatting, I probably need to practice more free squatting.
What about like shin angle? Typical West Side box squat, you know, you almost go negative shin angle or vertical shin angle, where you personally and a lot of good raw squatters, shin angle is a little bit positive. You're getting a little more quads involved. Knees are traveling forward a little bit. I know you kind of stay a little more upright, you know, and your knees or your shin angle's pretty similar with both. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what about the guys that get a little quads?
I think that still comes back not so much as a technical error as much as it is a muscular imbalance. So most guys that are sitting in a squat and their shins come forward, they're not keeping the posterior chain activated and they're not standing up with their glutes, which is, you know, normal because of the patella creates a great leverage advantage for the quadriceps. So not only does the quadricep have a lot of muscle, but because of the patella bone itself creates a leverage advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So when you squat raw, you don't have anything to sit to unless you got really big hamstrings and quads. So my body knows I got those big posterior chain muscles and it wants to go to them. But most people don't have those, so it causes the shift angle to go forward.
Yeah, and due to the way some people are built or tightness in some areas, sometimes your knees have to come forward, especially some people that are squatting 2 or 3 inches below parallel, you know?
Yeah. And that's the other thing, too, is I think a lot of it comes back to just being taught the right way when you first start.
Right.
You know, and I just got lucky. The guys that taught me how to squat, a guy named Jim Dawson and Timmy Smith, they didn't really know down to the core what they were doing, but they knew good form.
Right.
So we built up on a lot of eights and tens and
five. They knew what worked and what felt good rather than what feels like shit, basically.
Yeah, I saw a picture of me squatting at my first high school meet, and my shins were fucking straight up and down. And I was just thinking, damn, I got lucky that I learned that quick. You know, but that's the thing I think is I don't look at it as so much as how somebody's built. I look at it as what they've been taught beforehand to create those imbalances, because you can teach anybody to squat with a straight shank no matter how they're built. I got a guy in my gym that's 6'5" and weighs 200, and he's just a construction dude, and he can squat 500. So he's 6'5", 200 pounds. This dude's a rail, and he squats with perfectly straight shank angles because when I got him, he was dog piss weak, and he had to learn from scratch. Versus if he was kind of strong for some normal bullshit commercial gym, I'd have had to break all that back down and then fix it. It would probably damn near been impossible.
Yeah.
So you're almost better off learning perfection of form right when you start. Then you probably don't have those issues. But I, you know, me and maybe a few other guys are the only ones that have been lucky enough as a kid to learn right from scratch, right or wrong. And that's where the form really becomes the issue, I think, you know.
Yeah, everyone seems to be pretty obsessed with the bench press. So, like, what, you know, what are some things that have helped build this 600-plus pound bench? You don't really see too many guys doing over 600 in a full power meet.
Yeah, a lot of it's coming back down to just arm strength. You know, I mean, you have to have super strong triceps in order to bench that.
Right.
And the other thing you have to do is you have to learn that the bench press is a full body exercise. I mean, you saw today with those military guys, we changed our foot position around a little bit and got them to use more leg drive, and everything straightened itself out.
Yeah, it took pressure off their shoulders and their wrists once they had their legs locked in a little better.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is you got to understand that the bench is from a head is a head-to-toe exercise.
Yeah.
And once you understand that, that creates a huge advantage to being able to bench big weights. But you can't have strong enough triceps. I mean, I think I just posted a video last week of me doing those skull crushers with 350 for sets of five.
Right.
And doing it strict as shit.
Right.
But that's why I bench 600. So if you ever watch any videos I put up and see this crazy shit I'm doing with my triceps, mm-hmm. that's why I bench that much. And the other thing, too, is that if you're a shoulder or pec dominant bencher, you won't last.
Yeah. There's only so much you can press that way and only so long you can last. Yeah.
Right. So I think finding the area that keeps you away from injury the most, which is being an arm dominant presser, which isn't the short term way to get better. But it also, if you're an arm dominant bencher, if your pecs and your shoulders get a little tore up as you get bigger from the big free bar squats, it doesn't bother me because I don't use those to press.
What are your go-to tricep exercises?
Well, I use a lot of variations of, you know, everybody calls everything that goes back a JM press. Yeah. I'm just like, son of a bitch. I might have been one of the only guys that actually even saw that guy bench, and now everybody wants to counsel me on what a fucking JM press is.
Right.
So
I know everyone makes such a big deal about it. It's like, just try to get into your triceps. Just work your fucking triceps. Work your arms.
Yeah, the big deal of it is don't do it the same way all the fucking time. Yeah. I mean, if anybody reads anything that I talk about, it's always about variation. So the last time I did a press like what I showed last week, rolling into the bottom end of my lip and pressing back, I haven't done that for a year.
Right.
The next time I do it, I'll go to my eyebrows. The next time I do it, I'll go to my throat. The next time I do it, I'll use a fucking football bar.
Yeah. I remember Louie was real big in all that. You know, he had different positions you would do extensions from.
Yeah, and it's just you just gotta your elbows have to be insanely strong in order to bench those kind of weights and do it long enough to get that strong.
Right.
You know, but like I said, I mean.
What about shoulders? Are shoulders, I mean, obviously they're a factor, but do you do a lot of direct shoulder work?
I do a lot of direct rear delt work, and I do a lot of direct lateral raises. I
kind
try
of
to
balance you out a little bit.
Yeah, because what I found was is if I do like pec flies, okay, and like front raises, which everybody does, it seems, all the time,
right?
That those two muscles, when I start doing them, if I do them for a couple of weeks, it already starts to deteriorate my bench form.
Oh, really?
Already in like 2 weeks. So it shows you how fast those muscles become dominant again.
Right.
So all I do is arms and lats, arms and lats, arms and lats, and I do front delts or pecs for 2 weeks, and it already fucks up my bench form. Like, it's amazing how fast that stuff tries to dominate.
Right. Yeah.
Just overuse and whatever else.
Right, right.
And then you were talking earlier about the lats being important, and we hear that quite often. What are some lat movements that you're a fan of to help increase all three lifts, really?
I mean, I'm a huge fan of doing – I do a lot of pullovers, especially with a standing cable.
Right.
I do a lot of rows with the reverse hyper. I actually just posted a video of me doing like a kind of like a upright, it's kind of like laying flat on a reverse hyper.
You basically are putting some other type of rope on the attachment to the reverse hyper and just pulling on it.
Yep. And I use like the bell squat machine. I do a lot of bent over rows with that. I do a lot of chest supported incline rows with kettlebells and dumbbells for like sets of a minute, because I found that the lats really adjust and grow from high volume. They don't really need to do heavy weights. I remember when I was a kid, I could do bent over rows with like 405 to 455 for like sets of five.
Jesus.
My back never really got a lot thicker.
Yeah.
And then when I started doing stuff for like sets of a minute, like 180 pounds for a set of a minute, they just was like, poof,
the main use is kind of a stabilizer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Stabilizing your shoulders.
But I think, you know, if I had to guess, which I haven't seen any muscle biopsy data, but I would imagine that the lats and super
maybe slow twitch.
I bet you they're all slow twitch and they grow mostly from high volume. Yeah, so I would, you know, I know Stan Efferding talks about that.
talked
about that earlier. So,
what about like recovery methods? You mentioned, you know, obviously staying injury free in this game and just lifting for a long time is, you know, kind of the key to getting strong. Proper programming, proper nutrition. Was there any other tips or tricks you have to like recover? You ice baths or anything weird?
Yeah, we have an ice bath actually at the gym, and I'll go down to the grocery store and grab like. About 40 pounds of ice.
We've been to your gym, by the way. It was fucking awesome.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah.
Oh, and I appreciate it. You let us do a Wounded Warriors seminar there. It was really cool. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. That was the one day that I just can't miss work, you know, because I'm working up with the fire department in that area. But
great facility, though. Like, you got everything you need, and I like the look and the feel of it.
It's fucking grungy.
Pretty badass, you know?
There's my blood all over the carpet, literally. Right. And, like, the interns will come up, don't fucking clean up that blood. That's my blood.
That's right.
You know? So
it's part of it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. But we use a lot of ice baths. I'm pretty big on massage work, like pre-contest, about 15 weeks out. Not a big fan of doing a lot of foam rolling. Not a big fan of doing a lot of actual stretching. I do a lot of more range of motion stuff. So I've been doing a lot of deadlifts, like off 100-pound plates, stuff like that, to increase my mobility. Because what I started figuring out was about 5 years ago, the more I stretched, the tighter I got.
Right.
And I don't know if it's just all the damage I do with the weightlifting, but when I started increasing my range of motion on my stuff, I started increasing my flexibility and my mobility. And that's when I started getting away from doing a lot of the actual stretching. I do a lot of...
So you do it more with exercises.
Yeah. And that's the other thing, too, is if everybody ever sees my programs or... I'm a huge component of warming up weaknesses. So, like, if I'm going to go in and do a bench press, right, and I'm going to do a max effort bench press workout, I'll do anywhere from 100 to 200 lat pull downs, 100 to 200 tricep push downs, and 100 to 200 rear delt rows before I even go onto the bench.
Right.
Because over time, it's light enough that it doesn't really affect my lifting.
Yeah, yeah.
But over 6 or 8 months, those muscles got a lot fucking bigger.
Yeah.
Because I realized that once you truly learn to max, you don't have that much energy left after you.
Right.
You know, if I go in and do as heavy as I can on something on bench, I got about another 25 minutes of accessory work that I can really do and make progress, or I'm just toast.
Yeah, I remember Paul Childress used to say that. He said, if you do the first exercise right, you're going to want to leave the fucking gym.
Yeah, exactly.
And not do any accessory work.
I'm very, very keen on doing weakness-directed warm-ups.
Right.
But I use isolated movements to make sure that those muscles are saying, hey, wake up, motherfucker, you got to use these things. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I remember you gave me some bench press tips a while back, and I've used it myself and used it with other people, doing a lot of dumbbell presses before you start your bench press workout. Mm-hmm. It was a real kick in the ass.
Yeah.
It,
I mean,
it helps raise your conditioning. You
yeah,
know?
When I get up to close to meets, I'll do 4 sets of 25, so I'll do 100 bench presses. I'll do 55s for 25, and I'll rest about a minute and a half, 2 minutes, then I'll do 75s for 25, then 95s for 25, then 115s to 130s for 25 before I even max.
Shit.
But I started realizing that I just wasn't getting enough volume to grow anymore. Like, not doing those warm-ups got me to a 560 to 580 bench. And then after that point, I didn't have enough volume to get the muscles any bigger. So the thing of it is, as you get stronger, you have to do more work. That's just the way it is.
Right.
But it has to be put in the right places and has to be done very, very smart. Yeah. So you don't have to do those 4 sets of 25 to bench 350.
Right.
But you're going to have to bench 600. And that's the thing is, you know, if I'd have known some of that starting off. And, you know, like I said, a 350-pound bencher would warm up with 20-pound dumbbells.
Right.
But those 100 reps, so you do... Let's say you got 20-pound dumbbells, so there's 40 pounds if you count them total.
Right.
400 pounds times 100. How much is that?
Already lost me.
A lot.
Right? So 400 pounds times 100 is what, 4,000?
Right.
So you're doing 4,000 pounds of work before you even bench with 20-pound dumbbells, which isn't shit.
Right.
But times that times 2 years.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking
big pecs.
hundreds of thousands. Yeah. Hopefully not. Hopefully big triceps, but... My point being is that little bit of volume sneaks in over time and starts really changing the muscle.
Right.
And it's not by feel. That's the problem that people have is when they're training, they think, well, I didn't get a pump off of that. It doesn't fucking matter. It's how much volume you did over a whole year.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where we get confused on what works and what doesn't, because sometimes things that work are delayed gratification. You know, what I did last year might start affecting my bench now.
Right. I think sometimes you have to find stuff that actually kind of makes you a little weaker,
yep.
makes you lift a little bit less weight. So in your case, doing all this dumbbell work, you might work up to 575 on the bench with a chain or two on each side rather than going to 605. So it's keeping the weight down, which may in the end be a little safer, even though you're slightly fatigued.
Well, it's not even that. You know, it's that and it's one other thing. The other thing is that if you're a full meat lifter or you're a military guy or you're a CrossFit guy, the chances of you doing an exercise when you're 100% fresh is nilch. So when I get done squatting 900 in a belt, I don't have the fucking energy that I had fresh to come in and try to bench 606. So I have to be able to bench that 600 tired.
Right.
So if I'm going in after a dumbbell warm up and I only got 90% of my strength left, that's going to feel more like it did after I get done squatting. So my mind is ready for that. It sets my ego down. And it makes me feel stronger even though I'm under fatigue. So after I get done squatting a world record, I still got energy left to hit a big bench because I'm used to being tired before I even max.
I think that goes against what a lot of people feel is that they want everything to be perfect when they're training.
Yeah.
And so that they can hit their biggest numbers when their biggest numbers should really be in the meet.
Well, think about this. I mean, we've all done lifting meets, right?
Yeah.
You done lifting meets?
Yeah.
What time did you bench?
Oh, God, it's always afternoon.
Yeah, but you don't know, right?
Yeah, you never know.
So my point is, how can you set your shit up perfect?
You can't.
Right. So when I got to the meet down at Raw Unity this year, because I don't check in because I try to tell myself, oh, man, you're just going to Daytona Beach. You're not working out. Right? Because my body, if I keep telling myself, hey, you got to go down here and do this crazy shit, the anxiety of the meet just kills me.
Right.
So I just tricked myself into going, hey, you're going on vacation, man.
Yeah.
You know, but why are you packing your belt and your shoes? Don't worry about it. You know, that's what I tell myself. But I got down there.
I like this inner dialogue.
Right. And
fuck you.
Yeah. We were in the PM session. So I get down there, and I'm thinking I'm lifting at starting at 8:30 in the morning, and I'll be done by 2 or 3 like I did last year. Yeah. They switched and put the heavyweight guys. We didn't start till 3:30 in the afternoon. Do you know how many people that probably fucked up? Yeah. It didn't fuck me up.
Yeah, a lot of
because
them.
I train at 8:30 in the morning, and then the next day I train at 4:30 in the afternoon because I don't know when I'm going to have to be mentally prepared. So I know that if I never – I try to tell people if you can, train early in the morning or late at night. Because those two times, if you're strong early in the morning or you're strong late at night, you're strong any time of the day.
Yeah.
If you're used to lifting at 1 p.m. all the time and you got to go in and squat at 8 a.m., you're in deep shit.
Yeah.
So it's never – what my point is with all that is it's never optimal. You don't know exactly what condition you're going to be in. You don't know how you're going
to
feel after.
Well, you hear about that in other sports. Somebody travels over to to Germany for a boxing match or something. They get there like a week early.
Yeah.
They get used to the different time change. Yeah. They get used to the climate, the area, wherever they're in. They're trying to adapt to that environment.
Yeah, and that's a rough situation.
And they'll also train at different times. Like they'll train at 1 in the morning to adapt to that.
And I think that has probably the most effect on most people's training is time change more so than time that they train in the day. So, like, if I was to come out here and say you were going to run a meet at Super Training, it's a three-hour difference from here to Ohio.
Right.
That's a big fucking deal because by the time I hit 4 p.m. out here, I'm dead.
Right.
Because I'm used to chilling out at the house at 7 p.m. Well, it's 4 p.m. here.
Right.
So I'm like, about ready to crash out. Right. I'm like, shit, it's only 4 o'clock.
Right.
And then I wake up. I'm still waking up. I've been here 3 days, and I'm still waking up at, like 4:30 in the morning because it's 7:30 back at home ready to go. Right. And I'm like, fuck, here, nobody else is up.
Right.
You know what I mean? So.
Yeah, Donnie Thompson talked a lot about this. A lot of the stuff you're touching upon. I mean, doing the conditioning work a little bit before your heavier work. That was something he did. He would do kettlebell swings in between his speed work.
Mm-hmm.
He would not wear a belt for his squats because he wanted to not go crazy, not go so heavy on his speed work. He wanted to concentrate on his form, moving the weight correctly. And he'd also take like 3 or 4 hours to do training session because he was like, shit, man, meat takes double that amount of time. I want to be prepared for how long the meat is.
But think about this. Isn't it ironic that we're talking about Efferding and Donnie Thompson, all these guys that are were in their early and mid 40s when they hit their biggest numbers, and they're the most conditioned.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Donnie Thompson's conditioning was fucking unreal. Like it was kind of almost funny to watch because he's a big fucking guy.
Yeah.
And he's got that big belly.
But that's my point.
You're watching him outwork everybody.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm glad you kind of hit on that situation because if you think about it, the strongest guys in the world are probably some of the most conditioned guys you've ever seen. Now it might be specific conditioning; they might not be able to go run 2 miles.
Right.
But you'd come in, like you came in with me. If you come in with me and you you're a fairly strong guy, but you're not used to the volume that I do, my dumbbell warm up and my lat warm up is going to fucking kill you before we even start.
Yeah, you need 135.
Same thing with Donnie. Same thing with Stan Efferding. So my point being is that the guys that are breaking the records, the guys that are getting super strong, are also the ones that are most fit.
Yeah, and Stan's conditioning came from bodybuilding.
Yeah, exactly.
And he put me and Mike through a back workout, and what were 3 sets in, and we were like, holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah,
like our lats were on fire right off the bat. I mean, he wants to do the exercise the right way, first of all, but he's not giving you a whole lot of rest. It's back and forth.
And that's the thing is that you have to increase work capacity to get better.
Meets are long days, too. People miss that out. Miss out on that. They,
10 hours.
By the time the deadlifts come around, they don't really want to.
That's kind of what happened with me. That's why I went down to, I've been going down to Raw Unity the last couple of years, or I'll do some really big checking into meets.
Yeah.
I'm like, listen, I put my time in. I'm not doing a meet where I start squatting at 9 in the morning and I'm done deadlifting at midnight. If a meet director wants to run a meet like that, don't expect Matt Winning there because he ain't fucking coming.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's be ridiculous. They pile up 80 lifters in the same day or 90. Yeah. It's like, come on.
Yeah.
You have to have a little bit more sense than that to have run that long like that. You know?
Exactly. Well, it's just the thing, too, is when you get up to a certain level, you want to compete against other guys that are pushing you. I don't want them to strip the bar back down to 225.
What are some of the things that you're noticing with working with the military now? Like, what are some of the – I think you've kind of mentioned to me before that just in general, they're not as strong as you'd like to see. So what are some things you're doing with them?
Well, the first thing is just teaching them the basics on lifting. I mean, we always are looking, especially at the physical therapy level and the physician level, all the injury rates.
Right.
But they don't have the gym or the athletic experience to realize what they're looking at with those injury rates. So if you got a guy who's jumping out of planes – and they're landing, theoretically, like they're jumping off of a 7-foot ledge.
Right.
And they can't squat 65 to 70% of their body weight, not even including the gear they're carrying.
Right.
And then you wonder why you have a 33% non-deployable ratio. It's because you're weak as fucking dog piss. And you're putting your body in a position where it's collecting 2.5 times body weight forces and you can only create, if you're lucky, one times body weight force.
Right.
It's not a hard calculation. Put 1,000 horsepower in a fucking Chevette and see what happens.
Right.
You're going to twist the fucking frame, blow the glass out, and tear the tires off the axles, right? And that's what we do with the military. We're asking guys to do extraordinary feats and not giving them anything back in order for them to be able to complete those extraordinary feats and not get hurt.
Right.
So we're trying to give everybody a 1,000 horsepower motor in a car built to have 100 horsepower, and it's just not working. And that's why we don't want to swallow our pride and say, well, running is just not going to work. Normal fitness isn't going to work. And the PFT tests and all the physical training tests were designed in 1960 where nobody carried body armor, nobody had GPS, and the only guy that carried anything was the dude that carried the machine gun or the radio.
Or the radio,
right. Now they're carrying 60 to 70 pounds of gear. Everybody does.
Right.
And the average weight was 160 back then. And everybody came off of a farm and a manual labor job.
Everybody's probably at least more like 200 or something
well,
now.
Well, I saw the data, and it was shocking. So in 1960, when we designed the 2-mile run push-ups and sit-up test, average body weight was 160. Average body fat percentage, 13.5%. Now, average body weight, 200. Average body fat, 28%.
Oh.
Whoa.
Wow. That's only military.
That's just military. That's just entrance to basic training.
Yeah, let alone how fat we are. So
is that Army specific, or is that any specific branch? Or
that's the Army stuff that I've seen, because I've messed with them the most. But my point being is we're not dealing with the same animal. So a guy that you take a kid, right, and he's been working on the farm with his dad his whole life, carrying shit out to the cows, baling hay, and he's
physical labor every day.
Physical labor every day, and now he has to go run 2 miles. Big fucking deal. You take a kid that's only played Halo. We don't even have gym classes anymore.
Right.
He has no athletic background, and you're going to do the same thing with him?
Nothing's wrong with Halo, but the other stuff I agree.
Yeah, but you get my point. My point is that I'm not dumb enough to take a kid that's never lifted before and put him under 315. Why are you dumb enough to take somebody and run him 2 miles?
Yeah, makes sense. Do you think some of this goes back to adding mass or lifting weights makes you bulky and slow? Why do you think some of the military is not even... thinking about what about your ligaments? What about bone density? What about all these other factors that will obviously help us?
Yeah, I think the thing of it is...
It may not be that obvious to them.
It's not obvious to them. Two, you got to understand that weight training, even for sports, is a very new entity.
Yeah.
I mean, we've only been working out with weights for football since the mid-70s. I mean, Nebraska, Boyd Epley came up with that in 1972, and I might have the dates kind of wrong, but it's right in that area.
Yeah.
So that's only been 35 years-ish. 40 years.
And then it took a long time to trickle into other sports.
Well, that
and
was
stuff.
Experimental.
Right.
So
yeah.
I remember Boyd, when I would go out to the NSCA, and Boyd would sit down and tell us the story. He was an assistant GA at the time. He goes, I think we should use weights to play football.
Like, what?
And the head strength coach was like, yeah, we'll do it. But guess what? If they get slower, we start losing games, you're fucking fired. And Boyd was like, oh, shit. Like, okay, well, I'm just going to go out on a whim here and try it.
Yeah.
And they tried it, and they all got better, and they dominated football in the 70s and 80s. Well, point being is the other colleges didn't even catch on to weight training till the mid 80s and 90s.
Right.
So now you're talking about this field's only 20 years old. The Army, me sitting down with the generals and talking with all the top level guys that I've ever talked to, always tell me the Army is like a huge freight train. It takes forever for it to get up to speed, but once it is, it's full blow. And that's the thing with this is we're still trying to turn those wheels, the initial wheels, to get them to train different.
Right.
Because they want to go off the stuff that they have data off of for the last 50 years. They can come in and take all of us and say, hey, you're out of shape and you're in good shape and you're in bad shape. And the reason they know that is because they just got data from 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And they can put you in kind of a scenario. But what they don't understand is that's not the same person they were dealing with in 1960. All they see is the data.
Mm-hmm.
So if they know on average you have to run a 18-minute 3-mile and you can't do it, that must mean you're out of shape. Well, that's not necessarily true. What if the dude runs a 10-second 100-meter dash? I'd rather have that guy than I would the guy that can run an 18-minute 3-mile. But they don't have that as their thing. So when I came as an advisor for the Pentagon, that's if you guys have seen that the military was changing its testing protocol, I was part of that movement at a small level. But I was part of that movement because I said, well, we're not testing the 40. I said, here's all your data. You guys know for a fact that you guys sprint for 10 to 15 seconds and then you rest for 2 minutes. That's battle. That's the way it is. You boom, you're breaking down a door, you're wrestling people to the ground, possibly shooting people, and then you're resting for 2 to 4 minutes before you do it again. That's real scenario. Real scenario is not put all your shit on and run 3 miles in a straight line, you're fucking dead meat.
Yeah.
But they realize that that's the only data that they have. So until we say we're going to change the testing protocol, I want them to run a 40-yard dash in a full kit. and use basically NFL testing protocol,
right,
and say, okay, let's see where you're at with this shit. You know what I mean? Let's take a 400-pound wheelbarrow and see how long you can push it.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be like carrying a dude with all of his equipment on and his weapons in a cot for a couple hundred yards to get him out of danger's way.
Right.
But my point being is that we have to slowly change the testing protocol, because even in the old Army, they're gonna train for what they test for. And if they know they have a 3-mile test, they're going to train 3-mile run. Yeah,
crunches right. for a minute or whatever.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. They're always going to teach to the test. I can say these guys know that my boy Will was shot in Afghanistan last year,
mm-hmm.
and he had been boxing at least once, if not twice a day, for the months that he was in Afghanistan before that. And mm-hmm. though he was in pretty rough shape, but he bounced back so much faster because of the shape that he was in mm-hmm. before he went into it. And he ran and did, and he lifted yeah. weights, probably bench pressed more than he ever had in his mm-hmm. life at that point. And it just made an enormous yeah. difference.
Strength makes resiliency.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is people need to realize is you can take the baddest marathon runner in the world you've seen, and I can guarantee you they look like they're fucking half dead.
Yeah.
You take a really strong guy that's really fit everywhere, and he gets hurt, he's back in 6 or 8 weeks. And he might start down a little bit lower, but he'll build up way faster.
Yeah.
And that's not coincidence, you know what I mean? But
yeah, look at younger people. They always recover from surgeries and stuff better.
Yeah.
They always recover from stuff a little faster. It's probably just because they're stronger.
Yeah.
You know, their health isn't as compromised as yeah, an older person.
That's exactly right.
Strength is never a weakness.
The body is used to operating under some stress as opposed to,
yeah.
it, you know, being at a lower level but not experiencing that kind of stress.
Well, and that's the other reason we have so many broke guys in the Army is because, like I said, if you're used to dealing out in the farm, working with animals and baling hay all the time, you're used to physical stress.
Right.
That physical test, you know, 3-mile run, push-ups and sit-ups, hell, that's a walk in the park compared to baling hay for 8 hours.
Right.
But how many people do that anymore?
Yeah, you know, not that many.
No. You have to change the way you deal with it at the basic training level. You have to get them stronger and more resilient to injury. And then, like I said, you know, once you get super strong, there is no way to train. There's just what you need at that time.
Right.
Well, we can't start people there. We have to build a base, and then you can specialize them to being a soldier. But that's the biggest thing we have a problem with in football and any kind of sport is we want to make a football player. We honestly think football needs. We don't think individual needs. Like, this kid has no hamstrings. It doesn't matter how much you go practice football drills until his hamstrings get stronger. He's going to do things screwed up.
Right.
Do we need to go back to the recruiters before they're sending these guys into basic and helping them provide some kind of a program before they even hit basic?
Well, that's kind of where my business is starting to take off. I've noticed a lot back at my facility in Columbus is I'm taking guys and getting them ready for selection processes, basic training, and I'm yeah. getting them all straightened out before they even go in there so that they can take the stupid-ass training and not get beat up.
Right.
They're more resilient. They're used to all that stress, and they're used to me perfecting their form under being tired.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, they don't get broke nearly as easy. I think if everybody was going to go into the military and said, hey, you got to go 8 weeks to a specialist and get all your shit straightened out before you can even come to us, we could save a lot of time and effort in the military because we can't fix the military problem because it's just too big. It's like all five of us. I mean, we all know how to train pretty well
right.
compared to normal people.
Right.
But five of us is not going to fix a million.
Right.
Right.
They need thousands of us, and there's right. just not thousands of us. I mean, how many guys would you say, if you couldn't train somebody and this dude had said, I want you to train me for $10 million, but
right.
I want the best training I can possibly have, how many people would you trust with that training in,
yeah,
in right, this
yeah.
country?
Yeah, not a lot.
Yeah, 4, 5?
Yeah. yeah. At most, I can think of maybe 12 to 15 guys right. that I would have a good shot of thinking they might know what they're doing.
Right.
12 to 15 guys?
Yeah, that's not a lot.
That ain't fixing the Army.
right.
You know what I mean? So that's why that stuff has to be dumbed down and be able to use to the masses. It's not that hard, but there's got to have to be a lot of more people to get it fixed.
What's it like? What are some of the differences working with these military guys as opposed to working with powerlifters and just kind of your average everyday person?
Well, powerlifters come into powerlifting because they want to be better. Military guys can come into military for various reasons. They want to kick ass and take names. They want to get away from family problems. They don't have, you know, they're trying to get out of poverty.
Yeah.
So you're not dealing with.
Yeah, some of the guys are kind of doing it for a job, right?
And they're, yeah, they're
some
just,
of the guys
they don't
are
have
lost,
anywhere else to
doing,
go.
Right.
Yeah, they don't have anywhere else to go. So there's positives and negatives. Most of the time, military guys come to me and don't do what I say. They're in deep shit. That's nice because then I don't have to worry if they're listening.
Right.
Because their boss has more control over them. You know, and that's kind of why I didn't like college and pro strength conditioning because you're just a paid babysitter.
Right.
I don't care how good you think you are. In strength conditioning, those guys don't have to listen to you
right.
most of the time. And especially if you're working at the more gifted of a school you're at, the worse it is.
Right. They're already gifted athletes. Why the hell are they going to listen to you?
Right. They already have an idea of what they think is working. And usually, if you notice, all these pro guys that are really, really good are getting training from not the teams.
Right. They're going outside, of course.
Like Michael Jordan didn't work with the guy that was at the Bulls as a strength coach. He worked with his own dude.
Right.
Right? Jerry Rice, same way. I mean, you can go on and on, but my point being is that's a big deal. And I think, that's the problem we deal with.
With the military guys, you have to have a different approach slightly, or are they enthusiastic about it because they want to get better, or are they kind of like, fuck this, I don't want to do it?
Well, you like the stuff, like when you guys, like, you know, you put me on front covers of magazines, me having a lot of YouTube videos, and when those guys come in, like, well, who the fuck is this dude? He's not built to be in the military. What does he know? And then they go see a picture of me, you know, doing their benchmarks for a set of fucking 50, and then they're like, oh, shit.
Right.
You know, case in point is down at 82nd Airborne less than a month ago, and two guys walk in. They're Delta. They're Delta Force guys. These guys are the baddest dudes in the world.
Right.
They walk in, and 82nd Airborne is looking around going, what the fuck are those guys doing here?
Right.
And one of them stands up and goes, you need to listen to this dude. We're pissed off. He's not talking just to us.
Right.
Like, I don't know how 82nd Airborne got this guy, but so then they're like, well, who is this dude? So they looked me up, and when they came back for lunch the first day, I didn't have to say anything. I didn't have to prove who I was or what I did. Yeah. These guys were like, well, if Delta Force is going to come listen to this dude.
Yeah. Well, you got to figure, you know, they're really good at what they do. They have to appreciate other people that are really good at what they do also. You know?
But, you know, it'd be like you'd be
real,
like,
recognize real.
It'd be, but it'd be like you sitting in a seminar and you don't know who this guy is. And you're like, I don't know about this dude. And then, like, you know, Eddie Cohen comes in and sits down and is like, you need to listen to that guy. That's what those guys look at when they see a Delta Force guy or any kind of SF dude. Yeah. That's like the next tier level. And they're like, this guy wants to listen to what he has to say. Then they go look you up and you don't have to show them anything.
Right.
So I think the more credibility you build, they're just happy to see me because they know they're getting the right training. They know they're getting somebody that cares about them getting better, and they're not feeding them a bunch of shit. And that helps a bunch.
Do you approach the SF guys any differently in training?
No, because most of them guys are just genetically gifted, but they still have the same weaknesses.
Yeah. That's a question that somebody floated out to us months ago that I just remembered when we were talking, that they wanted to know if there was anything specific that you did. I guess my question then is like from
– Well, let me say this. The SF guys usually are mentally tougher. They're able to withstand direction better. I can't tell you how many guys I've seen in the basic Army – that could have been SF and could have been badass at it, but they just couldn't deal with the upper chain of command. So a lot of it is, you know, if you're in the basic Army, somebody has to sign off for you to go to school, to go to special, you know, selection.
Right.
If you're a dickhead and those upper officers don't like you, you're not going to go to selection because they don't want you to go. They're going to put you back down in the basement and say, you're a pain in the ass. I don't want to deal with you.
Well, plus it'll reflect back on them. If you fuck up, if they recommend you and you fuck up, it's like, well, don't listen to that guy. His recommendations suck.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I think with the SF guys are usually a lot more keen to doing what they're told, but they also are a lot usually more genetically gifted, and they're a lot more hard-headed. Like, they're just it's that mixture. You've seen lifters like that before. I'm sure all of you have. The guys who are genetically gifted don't tend to listen the best sometimes. The SF guys and the Delta guys, those guys listen and they bring it.
Right.
And they don't they have an ego, but they know how to follow chain of command really well, so they don't piss anybody off on the way up.
Right.
I mean, I saw five or six guys in infantry out in Colorado that were physically gifted enough to be SF or Delta Force all the way. They just couldn't deal with authority.
Yeah.
So they just get kind of pushed under the table. You know what I mean?
What about dealing with the emotional and mental aspects of the wounded warriors?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of those things where Mark deals with that a little bit more than I do. I see the guys while they're still in service.
Okay.
And I've messed with guys that are messed up, but they're not discharged from it. Or they're so high up in the rank in, like, Ranger Division. Like, I had one guy I messed with that got shot in the head.
Mm-hmm.
But he could still perform his job, and they didn't let him go because he was so good. And because that's they got crazy. Millions and millions of dollars into those dudes by that time.
Yeah.
So they try to do everything they can to keep them as long as they can if they're still functional. And but the big thing is, like, the Wounded Warrior Program, I think, is one of those things that it's kind of like what we talked about with the general physical conditioning tests. If guys are used to the – If every Army guy trained like I trained, they wouldn't have as many problems because they'd bounce back from stuff a lot faster.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody's going to get an arm or a leg blowed off. You're not going to fix that with training. But what they're used to dealing with on a stress level, I think you see a lot of this post-traumatic stress disorder and stuff like that. A lot of those guys weren't physically strong even to begin with. Hmm. You know? And like my dad was in reconnaissance in the Marines in Vietnam, and And I remember literally one of the first memories I had was my dad beating somebody's ass out in public because he wanted to sit there and talk to him about how bad the war was, right, and all this and that.
Right.
And then my dad found out he was a fucking cook. And my dad literally had watched people get blown in half in front of him.
Yeah.
And that was one of the first memories I had of my dad. And I was like, Dad, do you ever have nightmares about like the stuff you did when he was sick? My dad died when I was 13. And I remember when I was about 12, I used to ask him questions. And he didn't talk about the military much, but he used to say that I wanted to join the military because I wanted to fucking kill people. I mean, my dad was like, I'm pretty crazy, but my dad was a whole other level. I mean, my dad was like, I was either going to the Marines and fucking people up or I was going to jail.
Right.
That's how I was when I was 18. I'm not that way now, but you know,
he said kind of like C.T. Fletcher's dad was like that, right?
He said he was just fucking out of his mind.
Yeah. And I just remember my dad never really having nightmares about stuff. And he had seen some pretty nasty shit. And he said, you know what? I knew what I was signing up for. He goes, I knew what they were going to train me to do, and if I couldn't have dealt with it, then I wouldn't have been in there. Mm-hmm. He goes, the problem you have with a lot of that post-traumatic stuff, I think, is we don't screen people well enough to get them in there, and then they're not used to dealing with any kind of stressful environment anyway.
Right.
Yeah. And now we got a major problem.
Well, it gets turned on, and then it can't get turned off.
I'm sure Mark has dealt with it. We've all dealt with it as coaches. Is you take a guy that's never lifted maximal before, and you throw him into a conjugate system, they're sink or swim because most people can't deal with failure. And I'm not saying that you know, doing stuff like what you do in the military is anything like weightlifting, but it has some relevance because guys that can't strain or straining is negative to them, they have a hard time being good lifters at all.
Yeah, they just stop. Yeah.
They just stop.
When they're strong enough.
You've got to be able to deal with stress to be good at anything.
Exactly. Guys that are successful at anything sport or military, can deal with a boatload of stress, and it doesn't affect their day-to-day lives.
Right.
You know,
and stress comes in many different forms. You look at somebody like John Cena, like someone who's really successful, who's got a lot on his plate. You know, stress is different for him than obviously somebody in the military. But the point is you're going to have to be able to deal with stress to get better.
Yeah, and I think we just don't prepare those guys for what stress is.
Right.
You know, they think because it's something, you know, a video game or whatever, it's a totally different world. But I just remember that sticking with me from my dad. It was just like, you know, he goes, if you don't know what you're signing up for, you probably shouldn't sign up for it, you know?
Is this why you're passionate about working with the military, because your dad's history and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think my dad would have, I think he would have really enjoyed, you know.
That's cool.
What I was doing with the military, because back then it was still, you know, push-ups, sit-ups, and
right,
and a bunch of bullshit. But
was he into any sort of training?
You know, that's the funny thing, is my dad was just like a cockstrong hillbilly. You know, I remember him having the strongest freaking hands. I remember screwing up at the mall one time. He just grabbed me by my fucking skull and picked me up off my feet with one hand. I was like six. I was like right before I got in a car accident. I was like, oh, my
That's
God.
That's a pretty big head.
Yeah, that was a big head. So I don't know, though. You know, my dad also was not really for the military either.
Right.
Because, you know, he was in that era where, you know, he got spit on coming back, and, you know, my dad thought that we were over there for the wrong reasons because he was doing shit that really wasn't in Vietnam and saw why we were really doing stuff. And
right.
I think that gave him a bad taste. But they would have
imagined so.
They would have never let me in the military anyway from my legs being fractured the way they were. But I like to be able to give back, because what I do is I go in there and I don't think of it as a job. I go in there and work with those guys because I'm thinking, if I can get them 5, 10, 20% stronger, what if that tenth of a second or that little bit of extra power saves their ass?
Right. Because
now, like I was talking about to you, Mark, earlier, like those guys, we like to see guys get stronger, and it's really cool. But I've had guys come back when I worked from Rangers, when they would get sent out on missions constantly because they didn't really work on like tours or like deployments. They got called in when they needed. And I don't know how many guys came back definitely like in tears looking at me going, that training saved my fucking ass. And that's when you're just like, huge eye opener. You're just like,
that's powerful.
Holy shit. Like,
probably, man, feels better than breaking a world record.
Oh, I mean, when those three guys sit there and was telling me that, it was just like, this is what I gotta help as many of these guys as I can.
Right.
You know,
that's fucking great, man. That's really cool to hear.
It's one of those things where you realize that something in your life that you've done for 20 years just as a hobby and you've taken it as a passion can actually make somebody's quality of life better when they're done with something or
yeah. You know, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's crazy. So,
awesome, man. Well, I think that's pretty much it, unless you guys have any other questions for him or anything.
No, we're good.
Cool.
That's a good end note.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really powerful stuff. And I think, you know, if you're not sharing that information about your dad with the guys that you're working with, I think you should.
Yeah.
Because I think that's really powerful. And I think they'll probably have even more respect that you come from that background, you know, being a,
definitely,
you know, being in a family of military. But anyway, awesome having you here. It's really honorable what you're doing. I think it's fucking great. And any way we can help you out, let us know.
Cool.
Where can people find out more about Matt Winning?
Well, obviously I'm all over Instagram and Facebook, but my website, winningstrength.com. We're just starting a website up, and, you know, as you can, I'm a meathead, so
right.
I have people that help me with that when they can, right. So it's one of those things we don't update very much, but just getting through and watching the stuff I do on Instagram and obviously reading your...
Is it The Real Matt Winning or something?
Yeah, The Real Matt Winning.
Okay.
Yeah, and then obviously my normal name. I think my normal page is full, but I have an athlete page on Facebook that anybody can like and get on. And obviously just reading the articles that I put out in your magazine as much as I can.
Right. Even just on Facebook and on Instagram, he's sharing out clips and always helping people with tips and stuff like that. So make sure you check all that stuff out. Multiply your hustle, multiply your muscle. May all your shits be tapered. I'm at Mark Smelly Bell.
You can find me at Silent Mike with 2 Ks, Instagram and Twitter.
I'm Jim McDee, SCTV, everywhere that I would want you to find me. Follow the show on Instagram at Mark Bell's Powercast, Facebook.com/SupertrainingJim, and Twitter at SGJimSack. And we're out.
Cool. That was awesome. Thank you.
Subscribe to Power Magazine at thepowermagazine.com. If you choose the digital edition, you can catch up on all the great back issues, take your training to the next level with Slingshot products at howmuchyoubench.net, and look for PSN products including NO Explode at bodybuilding.com. Mark Bell's Powercast is a production of supertraining.tv.